Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 407. This week, the questions are taken from guide 477 on the concepts for the Invincible class battle cruisers and 478 on the Italian Zara class heavy cruisers, along with the Wednesday videos on Britain's anti-slavery campaign and the West Africa Squadron, the first video in that series, 1780 to 1820, and experimental torpedoes of the 19th century, the ones that didn't really catch on, combined with the Friday video on the U-class, the almost hunter killers. So let's begin with questions. Admiral asks, when Fisher came up with these ideas, was he providing a whole detailed plan himself, or did he get one of his underlings to interpret his ideas into some kind of functioning blueprint? When it came to his ideas on battleships, battle cruisers, as they would eventually come to be known, and what we would see these days as fast battleships, i.e. combinations of both characteristics, Fisher had a long track record of actually developing placeholder specifications for these ideas, you know, all the way back into the late 1800s and the late 1890s, while he was in the Mediterranean fleet. He was writing up and proposing essentially battlecruiser, battleship and fast battleship ideas, but relevant to the late pre-dreadnought period. So when it came to having the opportunity to actually really build one of these things, he had a lot of concepts that he had kept up to date, and he would present those ideas. But he also had a school of naval officers who at least thought vaguely along the same lines as him and were kind of his protégés. And he would discuss the ideas with them, and they would come up with various sketch plans showing, you know, the layout, the armament, approximate displacement speed, armor, etc., etc. And they debated amongst themselves as to the various merits of the different designs. You know, some might be overall more powerful vessels, but they would cost more. And obviously, they're all fairly experienced naval officers, so they could make ballpark deductions of how much each would cost in time and money. And you know, you'd get arguments like, okay, well, this is, you know, the absolute most powerful ship, but if we go for that, we can only build two of those per year. Whereas if we go for this, which is kind of the low end version, we can build four of them per year, and then we have four hulls rather than two. But then, you know, what about crewing them? If the smaller ships need 75% of the crew, well, if building four of them, we're actually still going to need more men. So what about an intermediate version? That, what does that intermediate version look like, etc., etc.? And once they'd kind of hammered out, obviously with Fisher's final approval, what the ultimate specification was going to be in terms of armament, armor, speed, etc., Fisher would usually add a few minor tweaks of his own, and then he'd send it over to the Director of Naval Construction, and they would then take essentially sketch plans and lists of specifications and draw them up into either, depending on how detailed they were, a specific plan and go, right, is this what you meant? Great, okay, fine, we can develop the detailed drawings. Or a small range of options and go, okay, well, you said this, but we can do that in one of several different ways. Which one do you like? Which would then generate another round of discussion with an option being selected and so forth. Iron Blood Enjoyer asks, so I recently discovered design A47, one of the preliminary designs for the Fuso class. Seeing that it had the same turret layout of the Rivadavia class from Argentina, I began to wonder, if the Fusos had been built like this instead of having all their guns on the center line, would she have been more or less effective? Theoretically, she would have been somewhat less effective in this layout. So the overall hull design was a fraction shorter and the ship was a fraction lighter, although designed with the same ostensible initial top speed of 23 knots, but being somewhat shorter and thus having a slightly less brilliant length to beam ratio, she would have needed a bit more power. And of course, whereas Fuso herself could present a 12-gun broadside across a reasonably wide range of bearings, this Fuso type, while it could have presented a 12-gun broadside, would have been somewhat more limited on the bearings over which it could present that. Now, admittedly, the design may have been just a fraction more stable, because without the fourth turret in an elevated position, then there may have been some small savings to stability to be found there. But the final Fuso design also has a somewhat larger secondary battery. It has four additional 6-inch guns. So in terms of future modernizations, refits, etc., there would be less weight to lose, less secondary battery to lose. So while by World War I standards, it would have just been a sort of a somewhat less effective design, going forward into the interwar period and then the Second World War, the shortcomings of this design versus the final Fuso design with all the guns on the center line would have been somewhat more pronounced, and therefore the ships would have been even less relevant than they historically ended up being. Kazeshi asks, I really don't understand how the Royal Navy could be looking at designs like the Invincible prototypes and go with side-by-side twins instead of triple turrets. And if you can get two twins side-by-side, you must be able to make a somewhat oversized triple turret while you work out any kinks with the new system, right? There are a number of factors involved here, some of which is that, to be fair, by the time that Fisher was contemplating these designs, the triple turret was more of a up-and-coming ambition rather than a proven and effective product. Now, to be fair, you know, literally a few years later, it was a proven and effective product, but that's just how fast naval technology was advancing at the time, rather than, you know, the triple turret being absolutely proven and ready to go at this point. Plus, there was obviously the problems of additional complexity, potential for breakdown, etc. And the Royal Navy was a little bit conservative in its thinking when it was comparing twins and triples. One of the bigger concerns being that a single triple turret might give you a little bit more utility than a twin or a pair of twins. But compared to a pair of twins, you would be dropping firepower. So if you were going to employ triple turrets, you'd have to employ a reasonable number of them, you know, either two triples in exchange for three twins, at which point you're breaking even, or three triples instead of four twins, at which point you're gaining a gun and getting some other benefits as well. But even if you do that, there is the fact, obviously, that if a turret takes a hit and it gets knocked out, if it's a triple turret, you've lost three guns. If you've got a twin turret, you've only lost two guns. So in this kind of circumstance where you've got six guns in three twin turrets at the back, yes, it's not particularly efficient from a delivering maximum firepower to the enemy's face perspective as compared to, say, two triples with one superfiring over the other. But in the event that one of the turrets takes a hit, you've lost one third of your firepower in the aft sector here. Whereas if you have two triples and you take a hit to one of those turrets, you've lost half your firepower in the same sector. And at this point in time, turrets being knocked out by hits was A, anticipated to be a problem, and B, as it turned out in World War One, not exactly an unreasonable fear. The flip side, of course, you could argue is, well, if you have triple turrets, you can throw more shells downrange and there's less surface area to be hit, so the chances of being hit have gone down. But obviously these are arguments that they were also having at the time. And obviously there was a lot more going into it. So yes, while with hindsight, I would actually definitely agree with you that having, in the case of this design, even if they want to stick with the twin wing turrets, having two triples superfiring fore and another pair superfiring aft would be a considerable improvement. Without the benefit of hindsight, you can see why some navies, including the Royal Navy, would come to the conclusion that a somewhat inelegant multiplicity of twin turrets was actually better than fewer triples. Of course, not everybody, even at the time, agreed with that situation, which is why a few years later you end up with the Tegetthoffs deploying with four triple 12-inch instead of six twins. But obviously, there's a lot of different people coming to a lot of different conclusions, and sometimes they fall one way and sometimes they fall the other. Hans Lasser asks, wasn't the airplane on the Zara class exposed, or very exposed even, to rough weather? Well, there was actually a hangar in the bow for usually a pair of float planes. You can see this is on Pola, with the float plane obviously having been lifted up out of the hangar and ready to launch on this little catapult. But yes, as time went on, it proved that this was actually something of a weakness. It meant that compared to aircraft that were stored and launched amidships, like on British vessels or and some American vessels, or aft, as on most American battleships, at least the fast battleships, these aircraft couldn't be operated in certain weather conditions that those other ships could do, simply because of the bow dipping and rising and dipping and rising, which made launch quite hazardous, and the amount of water coming over the bow, which wasn't great. But the Italians went with the idea in the first place because their idea was, well, if we have to have aircraft, then aircraft are associated with a lot of very flammable aviation fuel and some ammunition as well. If we have it amidships, which is theoretically the best place to operate the aircraft from a stability and weather perspective, well, a lot of shell hits happen amidships, and then you have an awful lot of burning and exploding fuel where you really don't want it to be. And even with a stern mounting, obviously there are issues about keeping the aircraft safe there unless you have some kind of hangar built into the stern, but the stern doesn't descend as deeply as the bow, so there's less available volume. And also, you're going to have some issues weather-wise at the extreme end of the stern. Plus, there's the steering gear and other vital bits of equipment right at the stern. So if you do take a hit and the stern catches fire because all your aviation fuel went up in flames, that could be a major problem. Whereas, comparatively speaking, there's no vital systems in the bow. So that was kind of their justification for it. But they did also run into another issue, which was in really, really bad weather when you have water coming green over the bow and running down, obviously, on the deck. The hangar roofs, which obviously had to open up to let the planes in and out, turned out to be not 100% waterproof, which was also a little bit of a problem. So, and that's kind of why no one else went for bow stored and bow launched aircraft in any kind of big way, apart from the Italians. They had their reasons for doing so, as we've just outlined, but there were some fairly major drawbacks, including exposure to rough weather. Hank the Unobtrusive asks, did the British ever consider major design changes for the original flavour King George V's and the Iron Dukes as compared to the Orions? For example, 50 calibre, 13.5-inch guns, triple turrets, etc., etc. Well, obviously, there were a few significant changes, the Iron Dukes going to a 6-inch secondary battery over a 4-inch, and also the King George V's and the Iron Dukes using 13.5-inch guns that fired a heavier shell than the one that the Orions did. But there were also a number of other rather important changes that were introduced as time went on with these two classes. It doesn't appear that the British looked particularly into larger guns, apart from, obviously, as I said, the heavier shells, or triple turrets, because in this period they really were kind of rushing year to year to produce new ships. And obviously, each year they were having to produce a slightly different battle cruiser because you're looking at Princess Royal, Queen Mary, and Tiger as the corresponding, well, a Lion and Princess Royal, then Queen Mary and Tiger as the corresponding battle cruisers for the Orions, King George V's, and Iron Dukes. And obviously, they are somewhat more different ships to each other, certainly, especially Tiger, although Queen Mary is distinct from Lion and Princess Royal as well. So they were having to do that design work. They were having to do all sorts of design work for smaller ships. And honestly, at the time, the basic principle of the 10 13.5-inch guns on the Orions massively outmatched anything that Germany was building at the time, and early on outmatched and then later roughly matched what the Americans were building at the time as well. So there wasn't a huge press to try and play around with their main armament, but as I said, there was a number of other considerations that were taken on board. For example, this is King George V herself, and one thing you might notice if you compare her to an Orion is that the Conqueror as well, actually, of the Orions, the foremast is now forward of the funnels, so you're not completely smoked out of your mind when, the ship's at full power. And another thing that was actually very heavily improved in the King George V's and the Iron Dukes was fire control redundancy. So in the Orions, while you did have some redundancy and backup in your fire control, the primary rangefinders for your fire control system were in the rather compromised Foremast, which was, except on Conqueror, which was the last built. It was behind the fore funnel and thus had all the sorts of issues, and also had issues with the funnel affecting the compass, which was up there as well. Now, with the King George V and then the Iron Dukes, there was not only this fix for the foremast, but there was also considerably more redundancy built in. So each of the main turrets could now fire under local control with its own miniature backup fire control system. Additional large rangefinders were introduced in multiple turrets. Initially, the proposal was for the two superfiring turrets, fore and aft, to essentially become miniature fire control stations that could direct the entire main battery if something happened to the main rangefinder and or the main fire control systems, as well as everybody being able to do their own local control. Additional separate fire control systems were introduced for the secondary batteries as well. And that was actually quite important, because what was seen at the time was that the Germans retaining 5.9-inch batteries on their capital ships pretty much from the start, at least of the Dreadnought race, was part of the Germans' intention to use the 5.9-inch guns directly against enemy capital vessels, which to the British indicated the Germans still intended to fight at, relatively speaking, shorter ranges, whereas the British had gone in Dreadnought for 12-pounders and then later on in other ships for 4-inch secondaries, because they viewed the secondaries now as entirely to do with attacking enemy torpedo boats, and therefore they were positioning themselves for a somewhat longer range engagement using purely the main guns. And so when they were upgrading from 4-inch to 6-inch and discussing said upgrade from 4-inch to 6-inch, going from the King George V to the Iron Dukes, it was entirely predicated around engaging and stopping larger German torpedo boats, with the plan being to have enough fire control systems so that groups of three guns could engage individual German torpedo boats or destroyers. The British viewed the idea of, oh, we can also use the secondaries against enemy capital ships, as very much kind of, well, if we happen to have somehow ended up at that kind of close range, we can, but we absolutely don't plan on doing so, and hence the need for a separate fire control system, because obviously if you're going to have the secondaries engage the same targets as the main guns, you can just take all the data from the primary rangefinder system and fire control system. Whereas if you're deliberately going out with the intention of the secondaries engaging different targets, you need a completely separate fire control system for them. Oli Pakerano Oiva asks, I think, when you say that Captain Willis, this is in the anti-slavery patrols, was sued for wrongful capture, why were the members of his crew unable to give evidence in court? Were they considered too biased towards their captain, or was there another reason? It had to do with some finer legal points. Essentially, the slavers knew that if they sued the Royal Navy, the Royal Navy would just laugh at them, wave sovereign immunity, and go, yeah, and even if you don't necessarily respect that, we have all the guns, go away. We really genuinely do not care about you. However, what they were playing on was the fact that Captain Willis was commissioned by the Royal Navy to captain that vessel. And much as obviously the captain is the ultimate authority on a vessel when it comes to discipline amongst the lower ranks, essentially, they argued that Captain Willis, while he was acting under orders from the Admiralty, was also to a certain degree personally liable for any actions that his ship undertook, and thus he was being sued personally as an individual rather than as the captain of a Royal Navy warship. And since he was being sued personally, it was therefore a personal litigation. And that meant that when he came ashore and found out that this litigation was ongoing, he, legally speaking, had to hang around and answer the charges. Otherwise, obviously, if he didn't show up, he would automatically forfeit the case. But because, again, he was being sued in a personal role, it didn't provide any basis for the ship to be detained so that the ship in general could provide evidence, and obviously the ship's crew. And so what you ended up with, the situation of the ship had its orders to fulfill, and so the ship had to sail off with the crew to continue its mission, while Willis stayed ashore to essentially deal with what was, technically speaking, a personal matter. And what this meant, obviously, was that then once it came up to court, he was the only one who could give testimony in his own behalf, apart from the slaves that he'd liberated. And of course, the slave owners manoeuvred to try and exclude all of their testimony on the basis that, well, essentially, they just said, well, they're slaves, they're inferior to us, therefore they don't count. And therefore, they eliminated the two very large bodies of witnesses who would have completely contradicted their narrative, because obviously the slaves would turn around and say, yeah, you captured us as slaves, and you did it illegally, and we were freed correctly. And the crew would obviously say exactly the same thing. But if they managed to exclude both of those groups, which they did, then of course it's just down to, well, Captain Willis says, and we say differently, which is a very different form of argument when the court isn't allowed to hear everybody else who might otherwise have backed him up. Warrant Officer 2528 asks, so I was recently watching a video about the British East India Company, and it occurred to me, I'm familiar with how much people feared the East India Company's army, but what about their navy? Was it all just easy pickings, like Santissima Trinidad and Friends found in the American Revolution, or did the East India Company have any actual serious line ships in its fleet? And if the East India Company happened to be an independent nation, how would they have ranked on the world scale compared to the Royal Navy? So compared to the East India Company's army, their navy was far less powerful proportionally. And, well, there's a fair number of reasons for that. Firstly, per man, an army is much cheaper to operate. And, of course, the East India Company's army in India was also directly responsible for enforcement and of its regulations and laws, expansion of its territory, and guarding its existing facilities. So they had a direct influence on the amount of goods that could be produced and therefore the amount of money that could be made. Whereas a navy is, again, per person, a much more expensive proposition to run. And the East India Company was all about making a profit. But also it was geared, and for a long time during the period that this channel covers, it was referred to as the Bombay Marine. But it was geared towards a very specific mission, and that was anti-piracy combined with a little bit of support of its army. The East India Company was not in the business of building a navy that could go toe-to-toe with other large navies. So if you were, you know, supporting ground forces up and down the coast, you didn't need exceptionally heavy armament. You didn't need 24-pounders and 32-pounders. 9-pounders, 12-pounders, and the occasional 18-pounder would do the job just fine. And then once you're talking about at-sea threats, the most numerous threats were coastal pirates, deep ocean pirates, and privateers. And again, for those purposes, small ships, what would be in Royal Navy terms, unrated vessels, and a handful of larger dedicated warships that in Royal Navy parlance would mostly be sixth-rate frigates, with the occasional large ship that would be rated as a fifth-rate, again in Royal Navy parlance, although usually again with slightly lighter guns, even if the number of guns was very similar, comprised pretty much the extent of the East India Company's navy, because those kinds of ships would be perfectly fine for dealing with pirates and most privateers. And, of course, the biggest East Indiamen were themselves armed with anything up to around 30 guns, although, again, 9 and 12-pounders, but that's all they needed, generally, to see off privateers and pirates. If it came down to fighting a large, well-organized navy that might show up with, you know, 18-pounder armed frigates, or frigates armed with extensive batteries of 12-pounders and large numbers of professional military crew on board, the East India Company knew that it couldn't really put a force into the field to deal with those kind of forces on an extensive basis, and it would be ruinously expensive to even try. So they essentially focused their entire protection element in naval terms around dealing with the more numerous lower-level threats, And if it came down to, hey, the French are after us again, it would be a case of forming up convoys and either relying on sheer mass numbers of lighter weight guns to deter the occasional French raider, or at that point pointing out to the Royal Navy with some justification, hey, we're the ones who are essentially bankrolling this war by facilitating all this trade. Send some of your actual dedicated warships to help protect us. And the Royal Navy usually would do so. So at that point, why double up on the effort? Jacob Dill asks, could we get a video on HMS Ties? The story of how a fireship ended up surviving sounds quite interesting. Yeah, well, I can probably do a general video on the history of fireships, but just very briefly here so that you've got something to tide you over. The Royal Navy, by the mid to late 18th century and then obviously into the 19th century, had adopted something of an interesting position, which actually, to be honest, had grown up even in the 17th century. And that was that, yes, fireships were very useful, but coming up with fireships completely on the fly was a little bit difficult because ultimately, if you showed up off an enemy port or into battle with a bunch of warships, you had presumably taken these warships because you wanted to actually fight with them, not just expend them randomly. And keeping a bunch of rotting old ships that you didn't mind setting fire to around was just a bunch of additional expense, and they wouldn't last very long anyway, because, well, they were pretty much done for already. And so they came up with this kind of hybrid solution of, in the event of a major war, they would use old warships that were either too badly damaged or happened at the time to be somewhat degraded and therefore not worth using as actual warships. They would also purchase old merchant ships to use as fireships, and that would allow them to build up a stock of ready-use fireships during a conflict. But, of course, during the initial portion of a conflict, and perhaps on more overseas stations where you wouldn't have storage for these kind of vessels, you still need something to go with immediately. And that led to the rise of a small cadre of dedicated fireships. But, of course, telling people, hey, you're going to spend a commission or two sailing around on this thing that is explicitly designed to catch fire and explode, isn't particularly good for morale, and also isn't actually particularly useful. It's another money sink. And so the purpose-built fireships essentially end up being built as small frigates and then later a mixture of both rated and unrated sized vessels that could sail and perform just as well or close to as well as their dedicated warship counterparts of similar size and similar gun count. And this is the class lead for the class that Ties was part of, by the way. And by the time of a ship like Ties, you end up with essentially the only real differences being some internal layout differences in that a fireship would be designed explicitly so that the passageways up and down through the ship encouraged significant airflow. So when you stock the thing full of burnables and set it on fire, the fire grows and spreads very quickly. The gun ports would open hinged downwards rather than hinged upwards, because that meant that when you set it on fire and the ropes burn through, the gun ports would then drop open under gravity, allowing the preloaded cannon to discharge. And there would be some kind of dedicated opening or easy access opening for the crew to evacuate from. On some earlier ships, this was on the side. And in some of the later ships, it was a section of the stern that was designed to essentially be a really quickly openable door, which would allow everyone to evacuate to the ship's boats to get away. But outside of that, they were functionally identical to other warships. And Ties was part of, as I said, the last class of dedicated fireships built for the Royal Navy. And simply put, you know, when the limited opportunities to use fireships in the late 18th and early 19th century tended to arise, by the point that was a thing, the Royal Navy tended to look around and go, well, at this stage, yeah, we do have a few dedicated fireships we could use, but they are also actually sort of useful warships in and of themselves. We have also at this stage built up this stock of old ships we don't need anymore, so we'll use those and we'll keep the dedicated ships around for kind of real emergencies. And as a result, Ties sees out the entire Napoleonic Wars without ever getting set on fire. And in the aftermath, the Royal Navy essentially just goes, well, you know what? it's essentially just a slightly differently designed frigate. We're just going to call it a frigate now. And so she transitions over from essentially being on hot standby, pun definitely intended, to just being a slightly oddly designed regular frigate, which is what she finds herself in and as a role of when she's on the West Africa squadron. Kimasa Wright asks, the timing of the successful anti-slave trade bill in the UK, along with a few lines in the video about the influence of the war on the anti-slavery patrols, raises a question for me. What influence did the victory at Trafalgar in 1805 have on passage of the bill and the availability of forces for the patrol? So Trafalgar in and of itself had a relatively limited impact on the passage of the bill, far more impactful in terms of the French in the war was the fact that you had the whole conflict having become the Napoleonic Wars instead of the Revolutionary Wars, because as I mentioned, one of the ideals of at least some branches of the French revolutionaries, given that they did have a habit of chopping each other's heads off at the slightest provocation, was the idea of universal emancipation. They were very much against the slave trade, I say, at least some of them. And that slightly complicated things for the abolitionists in the early part of the Revolutionary Wars, because some people, especially the people who wanted to keep slavery, kind of drew a false equivalence and went, aha, well, these French revolutionaries are anti-abolitionist and we all hate them because they're anti-monarchist and, well, they've declared war on us and various other things. And therefore, because you happen to share this one view with them, talking to the British abolitionists, you must therefore be in league with them, and therefore you are traitors, and, you know, therefore we can ignore everything you say. Napoleon, having kind of taken over from the broader French Revolutionary Council and then promptly reinstated slavery, meant it was now much harder to point fingers and go, ha, ha, look, look, you're agreeing with the French, you're agreeing with the French, because, well, now the abolitionists weren't agreeing with the French, and in fact, the abolitionists could kind of turn that back around and go, oh, well, actually, you British people who want to keep slavery, you are now in agreement with Napoleon, and everyone hates Napoleon. And then, of course, Napoleon, well, at least his overseas naval ambitions get knocked down a significant peg or two at Trafalgar, and not only does that served to kind of further humiliate Napoleon and therefore by extension anyone who agreed with any of his policies, but also it relaxes the perceived threat of invasion somewhat in the UK. And that means that Parliament feels a little bit more comfortable addressing bills and other issues that are being raised that aren't strictly to do with how do we best defeat the French. So it kind of smoothed the way in that respect, in sort of calming Parliament down generally. But also, because while the Royal Navy still does have to maintain a blockade of French-held and French-allied ports and, you know, dealing with the naval forces that are there, by smashing a good portion of the Franco-Spanish battle fleet, it also meant that there were fewer ships needed on those blockades, and that meant a relaxation of the amount of resources required, including things like frigates for scouting and patrol, off of the various blockaded ports. And that meant there were more resources to put to places like the West Africa Squadron, which of course then could be used for anti-slavery patrols. So I think even if those resources had been needed elsewhere, the bill still would have passed, but enforcement of it would have been considerably more difficult. Putting a ship or two on the West Africa Squadron probably still would have happened because there was obviously also the protection of trade issue going on. But with only one or two ships there, enforcement of the anti-slavery regulations would have been much less effective. And obviously they would have spent more of their time on commerce protection duty. Whereas with that slight easing of resource requirements for blockading of Europe, you could put more ships down there, which meant you could also dedicate more of those ships' time to anti-slavery duties, since the commerce protection element of things was being split between many hulls. Augmented Gravity asks, I remember the Whitehead was the first torpedo I really knew the name of, as it was used during the Battle of Drawback Sound when Blücher was sunk. But it being pointed out that this was an antique weapon, even at that point, meant that my question is, what version of the Whitehead was this? And is there any more general information about this specific incident? As I couldn't find much about it with regards to the torpedo part specifically. Well, there will be considerably more information when I actually cover the Battle of Drawback Sound, including extensive footage of my visit to Oscarsborg Fortress. Although I do need to pop back to Oscarsborg at some point just to pick up a few things which I missed recording when I was there the first time. Nonetheless, one of the useful things they have there, as well as the actual original torpedo launcher area, is a board that lists in detail exactly which torpedo is used. So I will quote from that, although obviously it's in Norwegian originally. So the torpedoes used on Blücher were Whitehead Model 5D versions. They were 5 metres long, 45 centimetres in diameter, weighed 531 kilos, had a maximum speed setting of 31 knots, and initially had a slightly different explosive charge, which I haven't quite been able to translate. Norwegians, help me out if you can. The original charge is called Skitebomol. I'm going to guess that's TNT, but I could be wrong. In any case, from 1930s onwards, it's listed as Trinol, which might also actually be TNT. So let's assume it's TNT at the time of Blücher's destruction. So it could be probably gun cotton or something initially. The warhead was initially 100 kilos, but from 1930 onwards, it was updated to 120 kilos. So essentially 120 kilos of most likely TNT. Propelled by compressed air and originally manufactured in Fiume, the original Whitehead factory. Vicky asks, why did other torpedoes with firing pins that were perpendicular to the direction of travel, such as the Type 93, not suffer from the sort of problems that this design choice gave to the Mark 14 torpedo with its Mark 6 exploder? Some of it was to do with exactly how you guided the firing pin. So on the Mark 6, they obviously had these two little guidance rods, and they were fairly susceptible to lateral forces, whereas with some other detonators, you don't have that. So, for example, the PI-4C that I showed, the German detonator, regardless of what orientation that's in, the actual firing pin goes down a cylinder or a tube, and that is considerably stronger. That's far, far, far less likely to actually distort in the brief moments between impact and the thing actually being required to fly up there. So sometimes it's just literally the design of how that firing pin is being guided. But also, specifically with the Mark 6, for all the cost and the innovation that went into designing the thing, some shortcuts or lazy thinking was definitely employed. So, for example, one of the features of the Mark 14 was the fact it was considerably faster than the old Mark 10. But no one seems to have either told the people designing the Mark 6, or maybe they did, and the people who were designing the Mark 6 just didn't think about it, because the initial specifications for those guidance rods on the Mark 6 exploder were no stronger than the guidance rods for the firing pin guidance system on the Mark 10. And of course, the Mark 10, travelling somewhat slower, was going to exert far less force than the Mark 14 would when it smashed into something. And so essentially you had an under-specced, suboptimal anyway design of guidance rod, and unsurprisingly it ended up bending. Yamashiro Kai asks, if HMS Campania, formerly RMS Campania, was never sunk in her collision with Glorious and Royal Oak, do you think she could have been refitted into a full-length carrier? And what would this hypothetical refit have looked like? Theoretically, it would be possible to do, although I think it's relatively unlikely she would have proved to be of any tremendous use, simply because she is actually in the ballpark with some other early Royal Navy aircraft carriers. She's considerably longer than HMS Argus, for instance, and only 3 foot narrower. And she's even a little bit longer than HMS Hermes, although she is about 5 foot narrower in that case, and Hermes is about 5 knots faster, whereas compared with Argus, they're of roughly speaking about the same speed. So in terms of the smaller carrier hulls that the Royal Navy was experimenting with towards the end of World War One and the early late 1910s, early 1920s, she certainly would roughly fit into that dimension-wise. However, there are a few things that I think would mitigate against that being done. The single biggest thing being that she's a coal-powered ship powered by vertical triple expansion steam engines, whereas both Argus and Hermes are turbine-powered ships powered by oil fuel. Now, in theory, yes, you could, while you were stripping Campania down to convert her, replace her engines and fuel system with oil and turbines, but that would be considerably more expensive to end up with a ship that at that point would be roughly equivalent to Argus, whose conversion costs would be a lot less. But if they decided to do that on the basis that somehow this is cheaper than, you know, just converting some other merchant ship or something they've got to hand, perhaps they just want another experimental hull to play with for a few years, or maybe they just keep her as coal and vertical triple expansion powered specifically because she's going to be an experimental ship they'll discard in half a decade or so, I suspect her refit would end up looking very much like HMS Argus, perhaps a little bit lower down because she's already had a good chunk of her superstructure cut away and she was a slightly more low-profile ship in the first place. But yeah, she'd probably end up just looking like a flush decker, which would be very similar to Argus until she was gotten rid of. 22NF2 asks, in the movie Battleship, we see USS Missouri rapidly brought back into operational service with the help of veterans. I know it's a movie, but how fast would it take, really, for an Iowa-class to be brought back up to duty? And of the surviving ships, which would be the most viable for emergency recommissioning? Well, there's a huge amount of variables involved, and, well, obviously Ryan from Battleship New Jersey has covered quite a few of them in various videos, but the short version is, firstly, you have to determine what do you mean by bringing an Iowa-class back up to duty? Do you mean the ship is physically capable of sailing and, you know, wandering around the oceans with a bare minimum of the weapons functioning? Or do you mean full-on reactivation as was done in the 1980s? Because, of course, there's a whole bunch of systems on the Iowas at the moment. Obviously, some things like the actual CIWS systems have been removed, as have the active harpoons and tomahawks and things like that. But stuff like some of the radar systems, for example, are there and theoretically could be switched back on, might need a bit of rewiring and so forth. But obviously, these are all systems that are now 40 plus years old. So if you wanted the Iowas to be brought back to modern duty, you'd probably have to be replacing those, which would require time in a naval dockyard, as you know, in as much as just getting the thing working again, engine-wise, would take. So those are two very different scenarios. You know, activating what systems are currently activated on an Iowa and getting it out to sea so it could fire its guns and have a modicum of radar capability is going to obviously take less time than doing that and then pulling it into dock and stripping down all the 1980s renovations and refitting them with modern radar, new missile systems, communication systems, etc., etc. But just looking at it from a purely mechanical perspective, if you want a fully functional Iowa class, I think that immediately rules out Iowa herself. I'm aware that a year or two ago they did manage to get the third turret, the aft turret, rotating a little bit, but she was never fully repaired after the turret 2 explosion. So if you want all three gun turrets working, she's out of the running for most viable. And weirdly enough, she was also the last to technically be decommissioned. New Jersey and Missouri went first, followed a few years later by Wisconsin, but all of them have been museum ships for long enough. I don't think their time of being finally turned into museum ships actually makes all that much difference now, because we're talking well over two decades. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a toss-up between the remaining three, because Wisconsin, yes, she was decommissioned slightly later than the rest, and she did have the whole, where you have to keep her in sort of readiness for a little bit longer than everyone else. But at the same time, as far as I'm aware, since she was made into museum ship, she hasn't ever moved. Missouri, on the other hand, was dry docked about 15, 16 years ago, I think. So she's had a bit more work done to her hull, etc. Wisconsin obviously would need a dry docking to address those outer bits. And then, of course, New Jersey has had the most recent dry docking, one I was actually there for, but with the slight caveat that some of the work that was done involved plugging areas which are needed for the ship to be active, you know, water intakes and so forth, but are really unhelpful for when the ship is a museum. So some of that work would have to be undone, but she does have, you know, the cleanest hull and the most advanced underwater coating, etc. So I think from an external perspective, New Jersey would need the least work. But then, of course, you have to look from an internal perspective. The single biggest issue, which is something I've flagged up before in questions like this, is whether or not the main machinery, the engines themselves, are still functional. Because it's one thing to obviously seal them off, put all the necessary cosmoline and so forth on them, but over the span of a couple of decades, with machinery that heavy, you do run the very strong risk of cold welding occurring and things just fusing together. So, you know, have those things, have those engine blocks and the gears, etc., frozen themselves in place pretty much permanently, in which case it would take forever and a day to unfreeze them and or replace them, versus if the machinery is still technically reactivatable, then everything else is kind of cosmetic almost. But given the various material conditions and the external work, I think New Jersey probably just edges out Missouri and Wisconsin in terms of would take the least time to reactivate. And again, assuming that the machinery can be reactivated, you'd still be looking at several years in a dry dock to get all the, you know, the turrets working again, get the install missile systems, modern communications, etc., etc. It wouldn't be quick, but if you wanted it as a modern surface combatant, yeah, you're probably looking 2 or 3 years minimum as a rush job. It should be noted that in the movie itself, they actually talk about taking her out for a exercise run anyway, which is obviously not how Missouri is actually currently maintained, but it implies in the universe in which the movie Battleship takes place that the machinery has actually been kept in fully working condition and you just needed to light off the boilers to get it up to steam. Dubsington asks, between the shadow effect and reduced time of flight, it seems evident that a moderate increase in shell velocity could have a tremendous impact on gun accuracy. But the US Navy used the greater power of the 16-inch 50 to lob the super heavy shells, with the expectation that higher angles would allow for greater deck penetration, and seem to have never even entertained using the 16-inch 45 caliber AP shells. How could this have possibly been worth the trade-offs? Heavier shells and thus a slightly slower fire rate, having to manage a whole new ammunition supply, low velocity and thus lower accuracy, especially given that they didn't even know about the Yamatos at the time. What am I missing? While the US Navy used the Mark 8 Super Heavy in all their modern fast battleships, the only ones that didn't use them that had 16-inch guns were the Colorados, and that was because, well, their ammunition system was designed long before the Super Heavy shell, and they decided it would cost too much for too little benefit to adapt the munition hoists to carry the big shells. Now, with that said, the reason why the US went with the Super Heavy shells as opposed to higher velocity, flatter shooting shells essentially came down to the fact that if you draw the graph of velocity and therefore related to that obviously kinetic energy versus penetration over distance, the two graphs, if you're using standard weight shells and super heavy shells, cross over at some point. So below a certain range, a standard weight shell will be going faster and, despite its lower mass, will have better penetration than a super heavy shell, also helped by the fact it's hitting at a shallower angle and therefore the apparent thickness of enemy armor is less. But as you get further and further and further away from the ship, inertia means that the heavier shell retains more of its energy, and thus, although it starts off slower, by the time you get past this given point, you end up with the shell, the super heavy shell, that is, retaining more energy, therefore striking with greater kinetic energy, both because its velocity is somewhat higher and climbing the further out it goes, and of course it has a bit more mass to throw in there as well. So whether or not a super heavy shell makes sense comes down to where are you expecting to fight range-wise in a modern battleship engagement, almost regardless of your target, because if you are planning at fighting at very long ranges, then you do want a shell that drops down at quite a steep angle to enhance deck penetration and retains a good amount of its velocity, for which point you need a super heavy shell, because at those kind of extreme ranges, if you were firing a lighter shell, a standard weight shell, for example, it will have lost more of its momentum, more of its speed, so it'll be hitting with less energy anyway, but also because it will be coming in somewhat flatter, it will be more likely to strike the belt, but it will still be striking the belt at a fair angle. And of course, the belt is thicker, so if it's striking the belt at a pretty, heavy angle, and possibly that belt armor is angled itself, penetration becomes somewhat less likely, but the angle that it's hitting is still shallow enough that if it hits the deck, there's a chance of skipping off the deck. Whereas a super heavy shell coming in, yeah, there's a reasonable chance it's not going to do much of anything to the armor, but against the deck, it's got a fairly high angle of fall, therefore much greater chance of penetration. All makes sense for very long range engagements. But if you're planning for engagements to take place or substantially take place at considerably closer ranges where you are more likely to be punching shells into an enemy ship's belt armor, then having standard weight shells makes more sense because those shells will have, at the closer ranges, much higher velocity, more energy, shallower angle of attack, greater chance of armor penetration. And when you look at US battleship combat doctrine, at least the doctrine, which is how they're designing the ships, rather than Admiral Lee, who's fighting completely the opposite way around most of the time, US battle doctrine in the 1930s calls for extremely long-range engagements, high 20,000s of yards, possibly more. And in that regimen, the super heavy shell just makes more sense because it will be a more effective penetrator at those ranges. Now, if the US had adopted a more British-style doctrine, which is, sure, we can start shooting at each other at those ranges, but we expect to close into 14, 15,000 yards instead, well, at those ranges, the much, much higher velocity shell makes more sense. Not so much, to be fair, in terms of armor penetration, because at 15, 16,000 yards, whether you're using standard weight or super heavy shells from a 16-inch 45 or a 16-inch 50 gun, you're going to be punching through any reasonable armor anyway. But from an accuracy perspective, the slightly shorter time of flight and the shallower angle of attack, therefore, as you say, the greater shadow effect, would make the standard weight shells more a better choice. But the US doesn't go for that battle doctrine, which is why they go for the super heavy shells. And commensurately, of course, the Royal Navy goes into World War II with this idea of fighting the main portion of the engagement at 12, 13, 15, 16,000 yards, which is why they're not quite so enthusiastic about the idea, even though they are aware of it. John McCarthy asks, what were the key lessons learned by the US Navy from the cruise of the Great White Fleet? Well, there was a laundry list of lessons learned, which was quite useful for the US Navy, but the two biggest ones were logistics, which will make Sal very, very happy over at what's going on with shipping, simply because while obviously the cruise was a success, the US Navy became very, almost painfully aware that the only way they were getting around the world was by utilizing almost entirely, not completely, but almost entirely, British-controlled coaling stations. And obviously, this being the mid-1900s, there was no guarantee of continued peaceful relations with Britain, especially because at the time you had the Anglo-Japanese alliance, and obviously America was sizing up Japan as their most significant potential rival. So they suddenly realized, well, hang on a minute, if we end up in a war where Britain declares a very strict level of neutrality, or worse still, joins in against us, we lose access to the vast majority of the world's coal access, coal ports, etc., and colliers. And between the fact that, well, Britain is Britain, it's the British Empire, and the fact that they can put a huge amount of diplomatic and financial pressure on a lot of other people, a lot of other nations will probably not supply us with coal either. And if we end up at war with Japan, they're definitely not going to supply us with coal. And suddenly, the number of places the US fleet can actually go if Britain has decided it doesn't want you to go anywhere, even if they're not actively trying to stop you, becomes very, very small. And so this is what prompts the US to look both for new places where it can establish its own coaling stations, which obviously mean they're fully under their control, doesn't matter what anyone else thinks, but also prompts a rather significant expansion of the US auxiliary fleet, with various colliers being built specifically to take coal out to the fleet if it happens to go into an area where the US doesn't have a pre-existing coaling station. So logistics is a huge, huge thing that they have to contend with. The other thing, which I pointed out a few other times, is the shape of the bow. So this is USS Virginia, one of the ships that was part of the Great White Fleet. And as you can see, she has a bow that could almost be described as raked back. It has a backwards sweep as it emerges from the water. It's not fully raked back by the time it gets to the top, but it's near enough vertical at that point. There is very little, if any, forward sweep to it. And as you can see down the side of the bow, the sides of the bow are not quite vertical, but near enough. This has a huge impact on seakeeping. As they sail through both storms and seas generally, they discover that their ships are taking water green over the bow a lot, both in terms of volume and in terms of time. And this is really bad both for just general cruising efficiency, because it slows ships down. It's also bad for the crew's health, because you get lots of water cascading in places you don't want it to be. And it's very bad for the ability to fight the ship, because it means the forward turrets and casements are very often completely inoperable. By the time they get back, although they've very rapidly reported these issues, a number of early US dreadnought classes are already under construction. So there's not a huge amount they can do about that. But when you look at the later US 12-inch dreadnoughts, and then obviously on to New York, Texas, and the Standards, although they don't completely revise bow design immediately, what you will see is a shift fairly quickly to a bow design that not only has some forward rake, even if coming out of the water it has a backward rake, you now start to see a forward rake at the top, but also considerably more flare. So if you look at the South Carolinas, their bow design is almost indistinguishable from the pre-dreadnoughts. Then you look at the Delawares, and there's a very slight bit of forward rake at the top, but not huge, and there's not a lot of flare either, because they're under construction at the time. Then you look at the Floridas, and they have a somewhat more pronounced flare at the top of the bow, even though they still have a rearwards rake at the waterline, but there is considerably more flare going on with them. Then you look at the Wyomings, and they have a similar bow shape to the Floridas in a lot of ways, but with even more flare occurring. Then you look at the New York and Texas, and again, although there's not a huge amount of forward arc on the top of the bow, they do have a huge amount of bow flare compared to most of the 12-inch ships. And you kind of see this progressing through the Nevadas and the Pennsylvanias. They're still not really all that big on forward rake, but there's a considerable amount of bow flare now present. And then you get finally onto the New Mexicos, where not only is there flare, but also you now have a very forward extended bow. John Whitlock asks, I've received the marvellous book on HMS Hood. In it, there's a statement that Hood's powder handling procedures and equipment were improved over those in the battle cruisers at Jutland. I've read that the probable cause of explosions at Jutland was the Royal Navy allowing deviation in handling procedures to increase the rate of fire. Is there a source you could recommend on the investigation, or have you done a video? I haven't done a specific video on the exact sequence of improvements and changes that have been made, but after Jutland. I have made videos that have referenced it, like I did one on cordite, which explains it, because it's not just handling procedures. I think there was definitely something up with the particular kind of cordite that the Royal Navy was using at Jutland, or more specifically, the fact they were retaining older cordite, which we do have evidence for, and which would have caused significant safety hazards, even if everything else had been going fine. But if you want to look further into both the investigation and the improvements that were made, a good starting point is on the Dreadnought Project website. If you search for, I believe the term is either a trail of cordite or a chain of cordite, and append that with Dreadnought Project, you'll come across the relevant page. And that details an awful lot of the back and forth in the immediate aftermath of Jutland between various officers who were looking into, and in some cases disagreeing on, what exactly had gone on and what should be done when it came to ammunition handling procedures. Subsequent to that, it very much depends on how you want to follow things up, because obviously that particular page has a lot of sources that you can go and look to, primary and secondary. And you can also look at some of the more in-depth books about British battleships, like Norman Friedman's one or Burt's one, for example, which will cover it, both the investigation and the improved engineering procedures in some detail. That would be my starting point. But perhaps it may be time later in the year to do a video specifically about all the things that they identified with ammunition handling and how they solved that issue, both in the design of Hood and in British battleships generally going, and battle cruisers generally going forward. Farrender Ritter asks, there were a few Royal Navy officers that served in Parliament while staying on their officer roles in the 18th and 19th centuries. Were they the Royal Navy's men in Whitehall? Did the Admiralty coordinate with them, or was it more of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge situation? Are there any examples of these politicians supporting or not the Royal Navy that come to mind? It was a little bit of an odd situation because, technically speaking, the Royal Navy did have representation in Parliament in the form of the First Lord of the Admiralty, who was a politician in the Cabinet and obviously part of Parliament, while also obviously being, as the name suggests, in the civilian head of the Royal Navy. And sometimes the First Lord of the Admiralty was also a naval officer. They just weren't actively serving at the time. And this varied some quite a bit, actually. I mean, towards the end of the period the Channel covers, the First Lord of the Admiralty was more traditionally an actual full-on civilian politician. But certainly in the 18th and 19th century, it wasn't unknown for the First Lord of the Admiralty to also be a half-pay Royal Navy officer or something of that sort. But when it came to more regular members of Parliament who might also be admirals or captains or whatever on half-pay, so currently not on active commission, it did get very complicated because, of course, they were, technically speaking, free and independent to voice their concerns. And obviously, normally, they would be pro-Navy in general. But why were they there? Well, that's where the complications came in, because sometimes they were there because they didn't agree with the current administration of the Navy, either potentially from a political or potentially from an actual practical day-to-day side of things. At which point, while they might speak in favour of, more funding, more ships for the Navy as a whole, they might fundamentally disagree with how the Navy was being run. And so obviously the Admiralty that they disagreed with, coordinating with them, wasn't really going to happen except on the most basic of issues. And indeed, you might have officers who were MPs speaking out against the way the Navy was being run at that particular moment in time. Plus, of course, when you've got representation at a cabinet level, you generally don't need to have lower level MPs introducing subjects for consideration by the Houses of Parliament, because you could just do that from a governmental level. Now, that's not to say there wasn't coordination if you were looking at officers who had perhaps retired from the Navy and just gone into Parliament, just and this was going to be their final career move, or perhaps officers who were MPs because they had other obligations at home, or they were injured and recovering, i.e. people who weren't out of step with the Admiralty generally. It wasn't consistent, and obviously a lot of it was backroom, so it's difficult to prove. But there is a low-level vein of issues being raised by, shall we call them, naval parliamentarians, where I would say it's almost certain that there was a certain amount of, you know, chatting with active duty officers and potentially even the Admiralty behind the people's backs. Because technically speaking, the Admiralty shouldn't be trying to get separate political leverage in the Houses of Parliament. But some of the subjects raised would be situations like, say, in the mid late 19th century, new Russian ships, or particular situations with France or Spain or the United States, where if the Royal Navy via the First Lord of the Admiralty was to introduce things, people might accuse the Navy of, oh, you just want more money, oh, you're being paranoid, oh, you're trying to set foreign policy when that's the role of the government, etc., etc. But if a notionally independent MP steps forward and says, well, in my experience as a naval officer, I find this development in this foreign country particularly concerning, or I find this state of things in this dockyard particularly concerning, etc., etc., then technically they're introducing it independently and using their previous naval experience as an authority to explain why they're making that position. And it makes it harder for everyone else to argue with them, because they can say, well, I understand this far better than you do, random MP from the middle of the UK. So, you know, back me up or shut up, kind of thing. And sometimes they, you know, officers would do this anyway because they didn't think the Navy was responding to a threat that they'd identified. But I think there definitely are occasions where someone has gone, can you kind of mention this in Parliament? Because then it'll look like an external thing. And then, you know, once the MPs are riled up, they're like, oh, well, we think the Navy should do about this. And then the Navy would just say, okay, calm down. We'll definitely go off and investigate that. You know, glorious parliamentarians, we will do your bidding. Meanwhile, just go, yeah, that's what we kind of wanted to do anyway. But if we'd suggested it, oh, they would have said that we're all grasping for extra money and ships. Once you understand the basic principle of most governmental level politicians, which is that they will not do anything that benefits anyone, even their own country, if it costs money, when it looks like the organisation in question, in this case the Navy, is asking them for the money to do the job, because then it looks like, well, they haven't funded the Navy properly previously, and therefore they're bad at their job, and therefore they reject that notion, and therefore they'll reject actually doing anything useful, regardless of the situation. But you turn that on its head, and you find that politicians will do almost anything and spend almost any amount of money if it looks like it was their idea and they can claim the credit for it, regardless of whether or not it's actually a good idea. And once you understand that, politicians are surprisingly easy to manipulate. You just have to find the ones dumb or egocentric enough that you can plant the idea in their head that this is actually their idea all along, and it'll make them look good at the next re-election cycle. And, well, finding dumb and or egotistical politicians is not exactly difficult. Jim Smitty asks, as someone who is reading a fair bit, I've noticed finding good quality material on the Austro-Hungarian Navy is a bit hard to come by. Well, in English anyways. So my question is this, what would be your top three budget options, say, under £20? And then mid-tier budget options, say up to 100, and then maybe top three options if I somehow win the lottery and have more money than sense. So a basic option, although exactly what price you'd end up paying depends very much on where you find it, your second-hand bookshop, a books, Amazon, eBay, etc., would be the Conway's All the World's Fighting Ships volumes, if you can get a hold of those, or maybe find some copy on somewhere like Everand or archive.org. They don't have huge amounts of information on the Austro-Hungarian Navy, any more than they have on any of the other navies, but they are relatively comprehensive in telling you what ships they had and when, and you know their basic capabilities. Then, having looked through my Austro-Hungarian section on my bookshelf, if you want English language sources, I would probably then recommend going to a publisher called Despot Infinitus, assuming they're still around. And there's an author called, and I apologize for my horrible pronunciation at this point, Zvonimir Freivogel, who's published quite a number of books through them, both directly as an author and co-authored. And he's done a fair bit on various Austro-Hungarian ships. You know, there's he's done a book on Austro-Hungarian battleships, submarines, cruisers, etc., etc. So they're all available for relatively decent prices and go into a fair bit of detail. There's also an author, Mihaly Kramely, possibly, who's also done a reasonable bit of work on Austro-Hungarian warships. And although it's a slightly older work, it's one of, again, the few that you'll actually find in English that's decent on the Austro-Hungarian Navy, is a book called The Imperial and Royal Austro-Hungarian Navy by Anthony Sokol. That was published in the late 1960s, but hey, the Austro-Hungarian Navy ceased existing just after World War I, so it's not exactly like there was going to be massive amounts of new material coming out. Just a lot of archival work, which the authors I mentioned before have been doing since then. And I think that will probably be my summation for published works in English about the Austro-Hungarian Navy specifically. I've got a fair number of other books that are in either German or Hungarian about the Austro-Hungarian Navy, but you said English only. And then, of course, you can go further back and look at the separate Austrian and Hungarian navies, but that's a whole other set of books and resources, including one which is actually a fairly extensive work on the history of the Hungarian Navy, which, as far as I'm aware, has never been translated into English, which I am in the process of getting translated into English, publication date to be confirmed. And that's it for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Of course, next week will be the Patreon Dry Dock, so see you there or in some other video.